Translation. Oh, my wife, who are very much attached to household life, if the principles of religion, economic development, and satisfaction of the senses are properly followed in household life, one's activities are as good as those of a transcendentalist. I wonder whether there have been any discrepancies in following these principles. Purport. In this verse, Aditi has been addressed by her husband, Kashyapa Muni, as Grihamedini, which means one who is satisfied in household life for sense gratification. Generally, those who are in household life pursue sense gratification in the field of activities performed for material results. Such Grihamedis have only one aim in life, sense gratification. Therefore, it is said, Yan maitunari grihamedi sukham hituchum. The householder's life is based on sense gratification, and therefore the happiness derived from it is very meager. Nonetheless, the Vedic process is so comprehensive that even in householder life, one can adjust his activities according to the regulative principles of dharma, artha, kama, and moksha. One's aim should be to achieve liberation, but because one cannot at once give up sense gratification, in the shastras there are injunctions prescribing how to follow the principles of religion, economic development, and sense gratification. As explained in Srimad Bhagavatam, dharmasya hyapabhagasya narto tayupakalpate. All occupations are certainly meant for ultimate liberation. They should never be performed for material gain. Those who are in household life should not think that religion is meant to improve the process of the householder's sense gratification. Household life is also meant for advancement in spiritual understanding, by which one can ultimately gain liberation from the material clutches. One should remain in household life with the aim of understanding the ultimate goal of life, tattva-jigyasa. Then household life is as good as the life of a yogi. Kashyapa Muni therefore inquired from his wife whether the principles of religion, economic development, and sense gratification were being properly followed in terms of the shastric injunctions. As soon as one deviates from the injunctions of the shastra, the purpose of household life is immediately lost in confusion. Om Gyanatirmanandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Guruve Namaha Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Srivasati Gaur Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. It's always educational in reading Srimad Bhagavatam to see how the greatest sages respond to situations that are sort of bent out of shape. Abnormal situations. It's very educational to study how these sages approach the situation, even a situation involving husband and wife. Here you see Kashyapa Muni has been away in meditation, and after quite some time, he comes back to his ashram, and he finds everything gloomy. Now notice the controlled way that he responds to the situation. It's very important to notice that controlled, sober manner, because actually, acharyas like Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur reveal that Aditi is crying, she's weeping, and also that Kashyapa Muni is kind of affected inside. He is affected by his wife's gloom and tears, but at the same time, his inquiries are so balanced, so controlled. So let's not forget what's going on externally, as well as what's going on internally. Sometimes, unconsciously, we may accuse the Bhagavatam of being a bit too stiff and too stern, a bit too otherworldly. But when we look closely at this account of Kashyapa Muni and Aditi, we find all the emotions are there. There's crying, there's gloom, there's lamentation, and there's also great sympathy and compassion, all going on without abandoning transcendental knowledge. This is what makes the difference. Our transcendental knowledge is not simply some religious belief. One religion has its beliefs, another religion has its beliefs. Now, transcendental knowledge is not theory, it is not theology. That's why in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna describes transcendental knowledge as, he describes it in an active, dynamic way. The boat of transcendental knowledge. When you are situated in the boat of transcendental knowledge, you'll be able to cross over to the other side. Or, Krishna explains that transcendental knowledge is like a fire that burns sinful reactions away. So these are very activist metaphors, so that we can understand that we're not simply involved in some kind of theology that's different from others' theologies. That we're not simply involved in mythology. We are involved in an activist, practical, laboratory process for producing results. What makes the difference here, again, in this account, is that Kashyapa Muni does not stray from transcendental knowledge while emoting, as they would say these days. And his emotional reaction is controlled, but it's there inside. We're going to find out in the verses coming ahead that after he makes his inquiries and Aditi responds, Kashyapa Muni will half smile. But that half smile, Vishnu Thakur points out, doesn't mean he's callous and insensitive. That half smile is that it's based on his remarking, just see the illusory energy that covers the whole world. Just see how attached people are to children. Now, don't take that as a negativist, cynical remark. After all, Kashyapa Muni is a big Prajapati. He's got lots of kids. But at the same time, he's just objectively commenting. Wow. This attachment is really very strong. Meanwhile, inside, he's very affected by his wife's turmoil and gloom. But because he's a transcendentalist equipped with knowledge, and he's going to engage her in transcendental knowledge, he half smiles. Smiles in response to someone speaking in Bhagavatam. The smiles are very noteworthy. What to speak of in Bhagavad Gita? Remember, after Arjuna showed the first signs of his breakdown. And in modern terminology, what Arjuna was going through in the first chapter and a half of Bhagavad Gita has all the symptoms of a psychological breakdown. So after Krishna drives the chariot in between the two armies and Arjuna has presented his breakdown, Krishna smiles very mystically. So what did that smile mean? Does it mean Krishna's hard-hearted? Does it mean Krishna has no feeling for his bhaktas? No. Srila Prabhupada explains that Krishna smiling at that point in the Gita meant he was thinking, just see how powerful my maya is. Just see the potency of my illusory energy. Arjuna's right here on the chariot with me. We're together. And still he's falling into maya. How amazing is my maya shakti. So, that's one explanation for why Krishna is smiling in that situation. Of course, in Chaitanya Charitamrita, you read how the smile of Krishna is like camphor added to the sweetness that permeates his whole body. The smile of Krishna, so enchanted Lord Chaitanya in his feelings of separation from Krishna, as Lord Chaitanya teaches us how to experience the full depth of love of Krishna by following the path of love of Krishna in separation. There's so many other places in Bhagavatam where you'll find a smile in response to an apparently pathetic presentation. What about Devahuti and Kardamamuni? caught him when he had left home. He had abandoned ship, so to speak, in a responsible way. It was time for him to go. He kept his promise to his wife, and then he was gone. So there was only Kapila Dave at home, the son of Devahuti. Devahuti made such a glorious presentation to her son, who was going to act as her guru. She said, "I am sick and tired of the disturbance caused by my senses and mind. Because of that disturbance, I have fallen into the abyss, the deep hole of ignorance." A very dramatic, evocative presentation. "Just look at my situation. I'm sick of it." Of course, that disgust is a necessary preliminary qualification for receiving transcendental knowledge. And we can look at ourselves and see how much that disgust is there. Or perhaps we think that, well, material existence isn't so bad. And perhaps in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives material existence a bad name because he just wants to kind of take things to an extreme to motivate us. But as you become a mature devotee, you don't have to take such fanatical standpoints. Material existence isn't so bad. I mean, it has some problems, of course. But we will prevail at least 50%. And prevailing just 50%, that kind of makes it all worthwhile. The more our transcendental knowledge increases, the more our taste for chanting Hare Krishna increases, the more, indeed, we have disgust at our own previous material activities. At the same time, we don't become extreme in our aversion to material existence. We simply act on knowledge. So Devahuti makes such a presentation to her son. "I'm sick. I'm disgusted with how my mind and senses have been acting." And then she appeals to Kapila Dev. "You are my transcendental eye obtained after countless lifetimes. You can take me to the other side. You are the axe that can cut down the tree of material existence." Very powerful metaphors. After she makes her presentation to Lord Kapiladeva for him to deliver her, Lord Kapiladeva smiles. So again, you might think, wait a minute, your mother has just expressed the depths of her problems, the depths of her inner turmoil, and here the sun just smiles. So what was Lord Kapila Dev thinking? The Acharyas explain that he's thinking, "This is my mother. How could she be in Maya? How could my own mother be in Maya? Anyway, I'll just use it as an opportunity to deliver transcendental knowledge." That's why he was smiling. So now we have the smile of Kashyapa. Notice, before he's going to answer and give his prescription to his wife, notice how he inquires. There are about 7 verses where he asks, in a very sophisticated and very advanced way, "Is there anything wrong?" Of course, in the age of Kali, you don't go through all these questions. If at all you bother to show anyone some sympathy, you just ask, "What's wrong? What's the problem?" Or, even worse yet, "Is there anything wrong?" But we notice that Kashyapa Muni's questions are the height of Vedic wisdom. In other words, in Bhagavatam, not only are the answers important, but the questions are also equally as important. There's never been a book like this. There's never been a collection of knowledge like this. People are answer-focused. I just want to know the answer. Just give me the answer. But the Bhagavatam trains you to pay attention to the questions. The questions asked by these great sages, by Pritchard Maharaj, Vidura, Kashyapa Muni, the questions are full, are themselves full of knowledge and contain so many answers. This is the glory of Srimad Bhagavatam. So Kashyapa asks his wife, "Dharma, Are you following the proper principles of Dharma in the home? It's very important because real human life is regulated. And Kashyapa Muni wants to know, have the regulations of family life been properly followed? If they have, then our home is as good as the ashram of a yogi. So I wonder, I'm looking at you, your face is withered up. You're crying. Has there been any discrepancy in following the regular principles of proper home life? And then he proceeds to ask, what about guests? Have you received guests properly? Has there been some slip-up in that department? And then next, have you been offering oblations, oblations into the sacrificial fire? So he goes over all the possible reasons that could cause problems. And then he gets, because he's shrewd, he gets to the obvious point. Not immediately, but because he wants to establish what is the proper way of doing things. And by his questions, he's reinforcing that. In other words, by the way, we do have standards. By the way, we do have guidelines. Are they being followed? And then he gets to the inevitable. Is there some problem with your sons? His wife is in distress. As you know, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says four types of persons approach him, all meritorious, sukriti. They all have auspicious value. And the distressed is one category. In my travels around the world, I ask devotees in different places, what is the main reason out of four that they came to bhakti? And everywhere, the predominant reason is distress. So Aditi is demonstrating this. Her sons are all gone because of Bali Maharaj. Bali Maharaj, in the last chapter, as you heard, became very powerful by worshiping the descendants of Bhrigu Muni. So he's very strong, so strong that he conquered the heavenly planets. He took over Indra's loka, and Indra and the demigods had to disappear. And they're all Aditi's sons. So how does a mother feel when her sons are all gone? The demigods disguise themselves in different forms because they have that ability to take any form they like. They became invisible. They took on different forms. So the heavenly planets are empty of them, apparently. They're out of sight. And Bali Maharaj has taken over. So, naturally, Aditi misses her sons. We should not neglect to see the human drama in Bhagavatam and think it's all super high transcendental knowledge. It's so far beyond us. And therefore, when we have problems down here on the ground, we've got to sort it out our way. Bhagavatam is like some nectar, metaphysical, super high text way out there. And here we are dealing with the practicalities of the 21st century. You can also say that about Bhagavad Gita. As we all know, when we want to be in Maya, the first book that we don't touch is Bhagavad Gita. you can see how that happens. It's just too intense, too concentrated. We think that Bhagavad Gita, well, it's a wonderful book, of course. It's our main shastra. But it just doesn't apply to situations today. We like to give ourselves a kind of false sense of importance that we who live in the real world. Now, it's amazing how we have made the real world, quote unquote, such a low standard. The so-called real world is full of lust, anger, greed, madness, envy, and illusion. And when the transcendental knowledge doesn't seem to connect with that so-called real world, we justify ourselves that we can easily dismiss this transcendental knowledge in times of crisis. And, of course, crisis must be there in material life. The crisis brought about by our material mind and senses, the crisis brought about by external events, we're always plagued by something. So the test of a devotee is how we take shelter of transcendental knowledge rather than push it aside saying, look, We got to deal with the real world. The real world's all about hard work, family affairs, trying to control your mind and senses, trying to fulfill yourself, trying to entertain yourself, solving financial problems, solving political problems. Bhagavad Gita is nice, but it's a bit abstract. Then we have to remind ourselves that, look at the situation Krishna spoke Bhagavad Gita in. The most pragmatic, quote-unquote, real-world situation you can imagine. On a battlefield, he's speaking in between two opposing armies. And, as you know, Krishna's not speaking to a brahmachari or a sannyasi. He's speaking not to a brahmana. He's speaking to Arjuna, who is a kshatriya and a family man. So similarly, we can look at this section of Bhagavatam and think, look, Kashyapa Muni, he's way up there. he's so advanced. I mean, really, how is what he's saying applying to us? Part of humility in approaching transcendental knowledge is to let it enter our head and heart and shape us, rather than we push it away. Oh, it really doesn't apply completely, and I've got to sort things out myself. The more we read Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam and let it challenge us, well, the Shastra says this, I'm not thinking that way. I obviously have a problem. How am I going to rectify that problem? The more we allow the Shastra to shape us in that way, instead of our shaping the Shastra, the more that we can have a steady progress, even in the storms of the age of Kali. So Kashyapa's statements are very important for us, how he approaches a problem. There are other sections of the Bhagavatam where we can also learn how a sage approaches a deep internal problem. Think of Chitraketu. Angira Rishi was touring the universe, and he happened to show up at Chitraketu's court. And how does Chitraketu Maharaj receive him? He sits, Angira Rishi, on his throne, and he worships him. And then Angira Rishi sits at the feet of, Chitraketu sits at the feet of Angira Rishi. And very humbly inquires, first controlling his mind and senses, and then he attempts to soak up knowledge coming from Angira Rishi. So how does Angira Rishi respond to Chitraketu's obviously gloomy situation? He again questions, just as we see here, in a very glorious way. He's talking to a kshatriya. So how do you say, how's everything going to a kshatriya? You start asking, is everything under control? How is the Ishwara Bhava working out? Are all your citizens submissive? Are your ministers submissive? Are your wives submissive? Is everyone doing what you say? This is Angira Rishi. Inquiring according to time and place. And time and place are very important in Vedic culture. Not that you just ask haphazardly, hey, how are you doing? What's going on? No, whom are you speaking to? So Angira Rishi is speaking to a kshatriya. And so he asks about control. He asks about subordination of the followers. And then he ends his inquiries by saying, is your mind under control? If your mind's under control, then you'll be able to control others. Otherwise, if your mind's not under control. So, Chitraketu is sitting there, gloomy, withered face, and presents that I don't have a son. Other places in Srimad Bhagavatam where you can study the inquiries made in a very sage-like way to someone who is obviously depressed and gloomy. When Arjuna returned from Dwarka in the first canto, Yudhisthira had already intuited, look at the signs, look at the inauspicious symptoms happening all around. Could it be that Krishna has left this world? And then Arjuna returns, and Yudhisthira starts questioning him. And you can see So much about social duties, social obligations, what a chatri is supposed to, what are the standards he's supposed to fulfill. Yudhisthira's questions cover the whole range. And then finally Yudhisthira gets to the obvious. Or could it be that Lord Krishna is no longer amongst us? You can also look at Narada Muni approaching Vyasadeva in the first canto. Vyasadeva had already started to interrogate himself. What's wrong with me? Why am I not satisfied? Perhaps it could be that I haven't glorified Krishna enough. He had already started that very necessary process of self-analysis. And then Narada Muni comes and starts questioning him. Are you identifying with the body and mind as the self? Could that be one thing? And of course, Narada Muni ends his interrogation by giving the verdict. You have not glorified Krishna enough. So this is the process of questioning in Srimad Bhagavatam. The questions are full of knowledge. And they reveal the civilized approach to problem solving. You don't approach problems in a haphazard way with uncontrolled mind and senses. You approach problems in a very skillful, sober, self-controlled way. And you ask questions based on the nature of the person. Another example, famous example in Ramayana. Vishwamitra Muni is coming to see Dasarath Maharaj because he wants to recruit Rama and Lakshman for killing some demon. So, how does Dasarath Maharaj greet a great sage like Vishwamitra Muni? He asks the classic question, how is your progress in conquering over repeated birth and death? That's the question for a sage. A question you ask a sage, a highly advanced brahmana. Your occupation is conquering over repeated birth and death. How is the progress going? It's one of the responsibilities of a king, of course, to make sure that all the other varnas are fulfilling their responsibilities. And if the king, Dasarath Maharaj, is actually going to ask such a sage as Vishwamitra Muni, how are you doing? He takes into account, what is your mission in life? So we can learn a lot from these methods of sages and kshatriyas in Srimad Bhagavatam approaching a problem. They're controlled. They're focused. They don't abandon their parameters and become willy-nilly. Even they're emotional and still they're focused, as we see Kashyapa Muni is in dealing with Aditi. Now, what about Aditi's problem? She is in distress. She's going to appeal to her husband, not for pure devotion. Nevertheless, her husband's going to deal with the situation by recommending she worships the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So this shows us the universal scope of the Bhagavatam. It knows how to deal with material desires. It's not out of reach for the so-called ordinary practitioner. Aditi is afflicted by separation from her sons. Kashyapa, as we said, has already remarked with a smile, just see the power of the illusory energy. Everyone is so attached to their children. And as we said, remember, he's a father. But he's just noticing that, while internally he's affected by his wife's grief. So he's going to give a solution. You're missing your sons. Here's a process, the Payavrata process of worship. And you'll please the Supreme Personality of Godhead in that way. And that will relieve your situation. So in this way, he takes advantage of a material situation to increase the bhakti of his wife. And that's a very skillful utilization of the situation. And it teaches us something. that problems will be there in material existence. Mental and physical afflictions will be there. Social afflictions will be there, even amongst devotees. Sometimes we rub each other the wrong way. But if we use the situation, the problem, for increasing our attachment to Krishna, then we become victorious. I was speaking about this point at a counselor's meeting in Kyiv, Ukraine. Just for the city of Kyiv, they have about 50 counselors. So I was explaining how not to be intimidated by problems. As you see in Bhagavatam, Kashyapa Muni is not intimidated. Yudhisthira Maharaj, even after intuiting that Krishna has disappeared, he wasn't intimidated. Angira Rishi wasn't intimidated in dealing with Chitraketu's problems. At the same time, though not intimidated, they tuned in. They were relevant through the eyes of knowledge. So I was explaining to the counselors in Kyiv that being a counselor involves dealing with lots of problems. It's not that simply all the devotees are goody-goody and have no problems, whether self-created or inflicted upon them. So sometimes it can be very draining upon a counselor or any devotee in a position of caring for others. Life can be a bit draining sometimes. So I explained to them something I learned from IBM when it was on top and producing laptops. So every company has a culture, every successful company. So in Kyiv ISKCON, they're attempting to establish a counselor culture for caring for devotees. So in the case of IBM, at that time, maybe 10 years ago, their company motto was, a problem is the portal for creating a lifelong customer. So they actually trained their people to welcome problems, because that way, through the problem, you deepen your relationship with the customer. So I thought this was all just talk. But at that time, 10 years ago, I had an IBM laptop. And so I was in Sydney, Australia, and the laptop started acting funny. So I called up IBM, and the receptionist who answered the phone said, yes, can we help you? I said, I got a problem with my laptop. I said, just a minute, I'll put you straight through to the technician. Put me straight through to the technician. technician asked me a few things and said, I'll call you back in 10 minutes and we'll offer a solution. So I said, well, that's interesting. Will he actually call back? Before he called back, 9 minutes later, someone else called and said, is your problem being worked out okay? We expect our technician to call you in one more minute. If he doesn't call in a minute, you please get back to us. Or actually, we're going to call you 5 minutes from now to make sure he called you up. I said, wow, what is this? So then, sure enough, a minute later, the technician calls. And I described the problem to him. And he says, sir, we need to look at that computer right now. I said, well, how am I going to get it to you? Sir, that is not your problem. That is our problem. In exactly 1 hour from now, we will have a courier at your door. We're going to take your laptop. I said, but I don't have any box to put the laptop in. Sir, that is not your problem. That is our problem. I said, wow, what is this? Sure enough, an hour later, the courier comes with a box, puts my laptop in the box, takes it away. 5 minutes later, the phone rings again. Sir, did the courier come on time? So what am I thinking? At this point, I'm thinking, wow, this is a great company. I'm always going to do business with them. So then they called back again and said, we have to keep your computer to make tests. We'll keep it overnight. Tomorrow we'll call you back. So tomorrow they called back and said, I need one more day. We're not quite sure what's going on with it, but we're sure that we'll solve it today and we'll send it back to you. But I said, but today I'm flying to Perth, Australia. That's like a 5.5 hour flight, the other side of the country. How am I going to get my computer? I'm already booked on my flight. I'm gone to the other side of Australia. Sir, that is not your problem. Wherever you are in the world, we will get your laptop to you. So what do you think when that happens? It's an ingenious way of doing business. I'm thinking, wow, I'm a lifelong customer. Of course, that was before Apple did its thing. But anyway. But it just shows you. They actually put their company mission statement into action, and it produced results. They weren't intimidated by the problem. They took it as an opportunity to reach into you and make you a lifelong customer. They have, at that time, at least anyway, I don't follow it anymore, but at the time they had the philosophy of the overkill. The problem is an invitation for them to do the overkill, just to lavish you, to show you how much they care. So they purposely overdo it. They call you up. Did someone contact you at the right time? Are you satisfied? So in this way, we can learn from that. We can use any problem as an opportunity to deepen our Vaishnava relationships, to deepen our relationships with communities in the outside world, to deepen our relationships with anyone. This is actually what Kashyapa Muni is doing with Aditi. She's got a problem. He feels bad for it, even though he's half smiling outside. But he's going to give her a means to increase her bhakti. And in that way, the situation becomes victorious. So this is why Bhagavatam is the preeminent shastra, because it always presents the victory, no matter what kind of situation. The bhakti somehow or other increases. In this way, we can see very deeply into this interaction between Kashyapa Muni and Aditi, his wife. There's compassion, there's emotion, there's crying, there's sympathy, and there's also the transmission of the deepest knowledge and the deepest solution to the problem. Worship Krishna, even though you have material desires, the best thing is to worship Krishna. So we might ask, well, whether you have material desires or you don't have material desires, you still approach Krishna. So then what's wrong with having material desires? Everyone can approach Krishna. In the end, everyone achieves Krishna. Srila Prabhupada explained a very interesting point. Because often in my travels, devotees ask me, what about Dhruva Maharaj? He had lots of desires. And look what he got. He got opulence. He got power. He can enjoy the material world. Yeah, Dhruva Maharaj. That's our model. Why can't Krishna treat us all like that? So I have to explain that Krishna knows how to individually treat each devotee. And part of advancement in bhakti is learning to trust Krishna. At the Ukraine festival, last year, I gave a seminar about blaming Krishna, accusing Krishna. And I was shocked at the numbers of devotees who publicly admitted by raising their hand, I've got a hard lump in my heart because of something that happened to me in my Krishna conscious life, and I don't think Krishna should have let that happen. It's amazing. 90% of the audience said, I didn't get something I wanted. Or something happened that I think shouldn't have happened to me. I was disrespected. Or my marriage didn't work out the way I wanted it to be. I didn't get enough money. I got sick. I was misunderstood or mistreated by this leader or that leader. 90% of the audience said they had some lump in the heart that unconsciously and subtly they were accusing Krishna for it. Why did you let this happen to me? Why? If I'm a devotee, how could this be? So processing those lumps in the heart is a very important part of bhakti. Because as long as those lumps of stone are there in the heart, you can't cry out to Krishna in kirtan. You can't cry out in japa because you've got that, you're holding back. You've got reservations. You want to glorify Krishna. At the same time, you have a grudge. Krishna, why did you let this happen to me? I was a devotee. I am a devotee. I've done so much service. So this is the problem with approaching Krishna with material desires. You can be disappointed in your material idea of how you should have been fulfilled or treated or dealt with, and then you hold a grudge against Krishna. So I explained to devotees that, yes, approach Krishna with material desires, but understand the liabilities. That's important. Okay, yes, akama, sava, kamava, moksha, kama, udharati. Whether you're free from all material desires, full of material desires, or lusty for liberation, perform devotional service. Nevertheless, the Bhagavatam teaches you the liabilities in approaching Krishna with material desires. It can be troublesome. So Srila Prabhupada explained that, yes, Juvaraj, he approached Krishna with material desires. If you try to do that, though, he said, it could take a long time for you to reach the desired spiritual goal. You will reach it. It just simply could take a long time. And while that long time is going on, you're prone to so many liabilities, disappointments, anger. Krishna, you didn't give me this. Why did you treat me like that? And therefore, your spiritual progress becomes, it can become a bit bumpy. So obviously, the best solution is to approach Krishna without material desires. Nevertheless, the Bhagavatam is universal. As you see in the case of Aditi, she had material desires in the shape of missing her sons. She wanted her sons back. So Kashyapa Muni, remember, commented about the material side of this. Just see the power of the Rusi energy. How attached people are to their children. But then he proceeded to give her the means for deliverance, and eventually she had the Supreme Personality of Godhead appear as her son. All right, we'll stop here. Any questions, comments from our Senior Vaishnava?